So with that, I'm going to turn it over now to Dorothy, and she is going to, let me go back to this, she's going to talk about pollution-climate interactions during the 20th century. Turn it over to Dorothy Koch. You may want to say a few words about your strange
migration
into atmospheric science.
Actually, I don't know whether I can explain my strange migration in the amount of time that I have. So, I did my graduate work actually on mantle dynamics and applied it to the planet Venus. And so this was one of the publications that came from that work. And so, yeah, you might wonder how I got to studying aerosol impacts on climate on planet Earth. One explanation is that this guy attached me to some cosmic rays and sent me back to planet Earth. But, yes, modeling beryllium-7 and lead-210, measuring first here and then modeling, and then somehow that got me working with people at Harvard and then working with people at GIS in New York. Another explanation is that all good research begins on planet Venus, and my boss actually did some work on the climate or the influence of dust on the temperature in Venus. But anyway, that doesn't really give an explanation, so I'll just go on. We're all aware of the increase in temperature over the past century, and that for the most part that's been attributed to the increase in greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide. And compared with where we've been in the past century with this increase in carbon dioxide and this increase both modeled and observed here in temperature, we may be in for much bigger changes both in the greenhouse gases and in temperature. So this is various scenarios being modeled with the GIS model. So, like it or not, we're stuck a little bit with relying on climate models to see where we're headed. And I've tried to list here a few of what I see as major uncertainties in using these models or in understanding the climate system. One is, what is the climate sensitivity? That is, how much warming do you get per amount of forcing change? Related to that is the cloud response. How does cloud cover respond to changes in temperature? Another one is how much CO2 and heat uptake have occurred and have affected the warming. The one that I'm focused on in my research is how have aerosols affected the climate? They've had some cooling effects and some warming effects. They've affected clouds and probably affected climate sensitivity. And I would argue that we may underestimate the influence of these aerosol particles. So aerosols are pollutants. They come from the combustion of fossil fuels and biofuels, and they have fairly short lives. They live about 10 days in the atmosphere. And mostly over the past century, we've been concerned about air quality with aerosols and not so much their climate effects. Only in the last decade or two have we started to consider their climate effects, and I've summarized them here. So first is the direct effect, which is the scattering and absorbing of incoming solar radiation. So sulfate is the biggest scatterer. Nitrate and organic carbon are also scatterers. And so they're cooling and to oppose greenhouse gas warming. But dark particles like black carbon, soot, also absorb, so they contribute to warming. The indirect effect is the so-called indirect effect is the effect that aerosols have on clouds. So they make clouds longer lived and brighter, and overall they have a cooling effect. A third relatively new to be studied effect is the black carbon snow darkening effect. So black carbon deposits on snow, which promotes melting, and when the snow melts more, then you have more exposure of dark surfaces, which leads to warming. These aerosol effects are fairly uncertain, and one good illustration of this was a paper by Jeff Keel a couple of years ago that showed that of the AR4 models from the last IPCC, typically the climate models have had applied a smaller forcing if their climate model was more sensitive. So somehow there was some kind of tuning going on with these models so that everybody could get the 20th century warming about right. And a lot of this forcing knob turned out to have to do with aerosol forcing. So if you want more forcing overall, then you have a smaller aerosol forcing. Now, we're used to this 20th centennial or bicentennial view of forcing changes in the past century or two, where the greenhouse gases are having a warming effect and aerosols overall are having some amount of cooling effect. And I think this view works fairly well for greenhouse gases, but aerosols have varied quite a bit temporally and spatially as regions have industrialized and then addressed air quality. And so this is, a deceptively small view of the role that aerosols have played in the past century. And this is nicely illustrated in the ice core records. This is an ice core record from Joe McConnell from Greenland. Actually, Joe McConnell was an undergraduate here. He's getting these nice ice core records from both polar regions, and they're very, very helpful in our efforts to model the last century. But anyway, so this is on Greenland. Black carbon here increases, peaks about 1910, 1920, when there was a lot of coal burning going on in the United States, and then declines almost to pre-20th century levels. And then sulfate is shown with the red, increases a bit with coal, but then much more with oil and gas burning, peaks around 1970, and then as controls were implemented, it drops down also to almost pre-industrial levels. So if you're looking at the change over the century of aerosol effects, you're comparing this and this, and you're not seeing all the stuff that's going on in the middle. This is a black carbon emissions inventory estimate done by Tammy Bond et al., actually about the same time as that ice core record came out. And so this is that North American black carbon. So she came up with a similar result of peak black carbon emissions from North America around 1920 and then a decline. But if you go to Europe, the peak occurs a bit later. And if you go to Asia, it occurs towards the end of the century. So here you have also large spatial heterogeneity and when these different pollutants were important. So I wanted to show some results from some recent work that we've done at GIS, where we're doing transient climate model experiments, similar to what was done with the AR4 models, coupled with the deep ocean, so we have full climate feedbacks. But in our case, we're doing full coupling between aerosol and ozone chemistry and the climate system. And this is especially important when you want to model cloud indirect effects and black carbon snow albedo effects. And it turned out, I don't have time to talk about this today, but the cloud indirect effect was very difficult to do in a transient model experiment, and it took a long time for me to get a reasonable result. And I've talked to several other groups that are now spinning up their AR5 models and are trying to do the same kind of experiment, and they're having the same problems that I did. So just to point out that running an indirect effect where the aerosols affect the clouds in a transient model is very challenging, because when the pollution really kicks in the middle of the century, you get a lot more clouds, and that does scary things to the climate. But I think this exercise will help constrain that very uncertain indirect effect. I've done multiple experiments to isolate the aerosol effects, and finally I wanted to show some results of some pollution reduction experiments. So the change in aerosol amount over the century, this is an aerosol optical depth or aerosol in the column, looks like this. So you see a lot of aerosol increase over the century in the polluting industrializing regions. But if you break it down by segments over the century, early in the century, between 1890s and 1940s, there was a small increase in aerosol amount. Middle of the century, a huge increase. And then at the end of the century, some increase, especially in Southeast Asia, but actually some cleaning up going on as well. So there's actually a decrease. And this is also seen in our model for the effect on surface radiation. So in the middle of the century, when all that aerosol increased, there's a big decrease in surface radiation, so-called global dimming. And then at the end of the century, some regions have brightening where the pollution is getting cleaned up. So this follows quite well with the trends that have been published by Oliver Wilde and others, showing a dimming from the 50s to the 80s, followed by a brightening. Now back to the top of the atmosphere, surface radiative forcing. This is for sulfate. Early in the century, there's a little bit of an increase in negative forcing because this is a scattering aerosol. Big increase in the middle, and then at the end of the century, again, because there's a decrease in sulfate amount, is actually a positive forcing because of the cleaning up of that. Black carbon has a different sort of pattern. So this is black carbon in the atmosphere and black carbon on snow. Early in the century, there's a big positive forcing from this absorbing aerosol. But even by the middle of the century, where there's already some cleanup of black carbon, there's a negative forcing because of the reduction in the absorbing aerosol. And that continues on towards the end, with, of course, increasing in at lower latitudes. So you can see both the heterogeneity in time and space and sign of these things. And so when you put it together, you get a mix of positive and negative forcings. Well, so now getting on to the effect on the climate. So this is observed changes in temperature broken down with the same kind of segments of the century. So observed warming over the century. Early in the century, there's a lot of warming. Middle of the century, not so much, and actually cooling in the Arctic. And then at the end of the century, strong warming again. And in the model runs that I've done, we do pretty well at the beginning of the century, quite well in the middle of the century here where the, well, I'll show in a minute, the indirect effect is important. And then at the end of the century, we don't get enough warming, but I don't have time to talk about why today. So then, because we've done multiple climate experiments, we can isolate the indirect effect and black carbon albedo effects on the temperature. So early in the century, when the aerosols are increasing, you get increased cooling from the indirect effect. And so, again, it's playing an especially important role in the middle of the century. But then at the end of the century, there's actually localized warming, again, due to the reduction of pollution. Black carbon contributes strong warming. Well, this is the black carbon albedo effect, not black carbon in the atmosphere. But it does contribute to warming in the Arctic up until about the middle of the century. But then at the end of the century, as black carbon is being reduced in the Arctic, there's actually a cooling effect from that. So black carbon has been an area of strong interest for me, and there's more and more interest in the policy community for whether black carbon should be put in with greenhouse gases as a way to slow global warming. And since it's a short-lived species, it could possibly have a very rapid effect. So there's a lot of interest in whether black carbon can be used to help save the Arctic. So this is an Arctic Council document. This is something from the International Council on Clean Transportation, Black Carbon Climate Science. This is UNEP is now also interested, UN, to buying the planet time by reducing black carbon, methane, and ozone. This is something that came out of Princeton. I mean, it's just too much to keep up with anymore, but it's very, very hot topic. So I wanted to perform some experiments using my climate model to see what happened when I took black carbon out, as well as comparing it with some other changes in pollution. So starting in the year 1970, I branched some sensitivity runs from my climate runs. In the first case, I took out all black carbon pollution, which is way beyond what anybody, I mean, just there's black carbon is a difficult pollutant to mitigate because there's so much coming from things like cook stoves and biomass burning. But anyway, so this is an extreme example. Compare that with what happens if I keep long-lived greenhouse gases at 1970 levels for the final three decades of the century, and compare that with what happens if I take out all sulfur pollution. So this will have a warming effect because sulfur is scattering. And so this is what happened with the temperature trends. The red line is the standard run with everything in it. When you take out sulfur, you get a big warming, big effect. But the black carbon reduction experiment and the greenhouse gas stabilization experiment didn't really have very much effect on temperature at all. And this is what the maps of these look like. So the sulfur reduction is a huge warming all over the northern hemisphere. So this is big unmasking is the word we're using now for this, I guess. The greenhouse gas stabilization experiment had cooling mostly actually in the Arctic, which suggests that maybe greenhouse gases, according to our model, might be a better target for saving the Arctic compared with black carbon, which had a very small cooling effect. And I think the reason, again, in this model has to do with the responses of the hydrology in the clouds. So it turns out in our model, when you reduce greenhouse gases, you actually get an increase in cloud cover, and that really helps reinforce the cooling of the greenhouse gas reduction. But when you take out aerosols, you actually get somewhat of a loss of cloud. And related to that is the change in surface radiation. So when you take out black carbon, you get a huge global brightening because black carbon both scatters and absorbs radiation. So the surface radiation goes up by a lot. Whereas if you take out greenhouse gases, you get a decrease in radiation at the surface because of the increase in cloud cover. Okay, so to conclude, the aerosol changes during the 20th century are really very dynamic, and I think we need to be aware that the impacts that they've had during different periods are larger than they certainly are over the century. So early in the century, coal burning from Europe and North America made a lot of black carbon, which had a big effect on warming and contributed to Arctic snow and ice melt. By the middle of the century, oil and gas was replacing coal burning in Europe and North America, so that made more sulfate, which contributed to dimming and actually dampened the climate warming. By the end of the century, air quality and acid rain concerns caused the cleanup of the sulfur, especially in Europe and North America, which led to brightening and warming. But meanwhile, at lower latitudes, the pollution has continued to increase, and it's a mix of scattering and absorbing particles. And the other point is that in our model, black carbon reduction is a less effective cooling strategy than greenhouse gas reduction because of cloud responses. And I hesitate to get too excited about that because it may be a very model-dependent phenomenon and needs to be looked at carefully in other models, I think, before we get too deep into using this as a way to mitigate climate warming. So the climate and hydrologic responses, not just radiative forcing, need careful consideration in mitigation strategies. Thank you.